From NPR News, this is News and Notes. I'm Tony Cox. History has been made. We now have our very first African-American president. Hordes of shivering citizens crowded the streets and sidewalks of the nation's capital to catch a glimpse of President Barack Obama's inauguration. Most watched a pixelated version of the commander-in-chief on the nearest jumbotron. We've gathered together a clutch of NPR reporters to give us reactions from their far-flung perches. First, we have Ron Elving, NPR senior Washington editor. Hi, Ron.
Good to be with you, Tony.
Let's talk a bit about the inaugural ceremony itself. Was there anything new or different about this one that you noticed besides Chief Justice John Roberts misspeaking while administering the presidential oath?
Well, that perhaps is not unprecedented either. Actually, I was struck by how traditional they kept it. They stuck with pretty much the usual program, and pretty much everybody executed the usual sorts of roles. One thing that I did notice was that Barack Obama went out of his way to walk to the helicopter afterwards with exiting former President George W. Bush and see him off to the helicopter.
How would you, in fact, gauge the reaction of former President Bush as he left the White House, as you described it? Would it be a combination of relief and maybe sadness?
And perhaps some resignation. He surely knew that more than a million people were gathering on the Mall today, coming from all over the country, not only to celebrate Barack Obama, and that was certainly their mission, but also in a sense of repudiation of his own presidency. It has to feel pretty bad.
You know, it seemed as if from watching it on television, Ron, that the crowd's reaction to both the ceremony and especially to Obama's speech was very respectful, I think would be a word I would use.
Yes, and there was a great deal of enthusiasm, of course, mixed in with that. But the interesting thing was here you had a throng of people going all the way back past the Washington Monument to the Lincoln Memorial, an unprecedented size of crowd, really, and then stretching up the streets in all directions. There was no way to speak to that entire crowd. You couldn't possibly work the room because there was no room. You were speaking to the world. And there was a sense that people had waited outside for many, many hours in the cold, and now they were witnessing something with awe. It was not really a political rally. It was more of a witness to history kind of moment.
Would it be fair to say along that line that this was an inauguration for all inaugurations?
Yes, I think it was unlike any other, not only in terms of its size, but also in its peculiar spirit. It was something that has no real analog in American history, and something that I think gives his presidency a send-off unlike any other president has had.
Ron, thank you very much.
My pleasure, Tony.
That was Ron Elving, NPR senior Washington editor. He joined us from NPR's headquarters in the nation's capital. We turn now to reporter Audie Cornish. She's had a ringside seat from the foot of the Lincoln Memorial since early this morning. Hi, Audie.
Hi, Tony.
You know, you're pretty far from the action that took place on the Capitol steps. What was the reaction like where you are?
Well, over here on the furthest westernmost end, almost of the Potomac River, is the Lincoln Memorial. And, you know, I asked a few people here the same question of why would you be here if you're going to come this early and instead of going down where it's closer? And they said, you know, at the footsteps of the great emancipator, this is the place to be on this day for the first African-American president. And it was interesting because even after the speech was done and lots of folks were heading straight to the parade route, there was a line, a sort of mini pilgrimage of folks who were headed up to the Lincoln Memorial, and they were there taking pictures and just sort of taking in the day, and also going to one of the walls and reading Lincoln's inaugural address as well.
You know, we know that they couldn't see the Capitol steps from that location. Perhaps they could see the jumbotron. How well could they hear the actual inauguration speech?
You could hear very well, and most people were crowded to this side of the reflecting pool where the jumbotron was. So on this end, it may have been a little bit delayed, but there was certainly give and take sort of reaction to the words of Mr. Obama in his speech. In particular, when I asked people what they responded to from the speech, I had more than one person say, you know, the idea of, quote, sort of picking ourselves up and dusting ourselves off. That phrase and that the way that was put really meant something to the folks that I talked to here who felt as though this was a time that they felt as though the president was actually calling them to service and to participation, and that was the thing I noticed the most and the folks I talked to after.
It really appeared, again, on television, watching it, that everyone was paying very close attention. You were right up there with the people. Were they really rapt by what was taking place and what was being said?
Oh, complete and total silence. I mean, honestly, once Aretha Franklin stepped on stage, people were completely rapt. A lot of folks had been out here since 6 in the morning. I mean, this was the moment that everybody had been waiting for. And so once President Obama took the stage, people really were silent and respectful. There was a lot of nodding. And a lot of people sort of looking at each other and sort of saying, I agree with this, I'm not sure about that. And people definitely, as you described it earlier, it was a sort of respectful hearing of what the new president had to say.
Audie, thank you very much.
Thank you.
That was NPR reporter Audie Cornish. She joined us from the National Mall in Washington, D.C. Now from Dr. King's famous letter from a Birmingham jail to the bombing of the 16th Street Baptist Church, Birmingham, Alabama, has long been one of the centers of the civil rights movement. Tanya Ott is the news director of WGHM in Birmingham. She joins us now from the historic Boltwell Auditorium, I hope I said that correctly, to give us some reaction. Did I get it right, Tanya?
You know, Tony, we've heard several different ways of pronouncing it today. It's Boltwell.
Boltwell, okay. How are the residents there taking it, particularly given the history of Birmingham and the civil rights struggle?
Well, you know, you're right. This entire day was wrapped up in history from the moment you walked into Boltwell, where across the front windows of the building, there were pictures of President Obama and then pictures of the civil rights foot soldiers engaged in rallies and protests in the early 1960s. That set the stage. You walked into Boltwell, you've got 6,000 people packing the place, red, white, and blue everywhere, video tributes and montages to the civil rights foot soldiers, many of them in the audience as well. There was one in particular. There was a tribute to the Reverend Fred Shuttlesworth, who listeners may be familiar with. He was really sort of the pioneer of the Birmingham campaign. He's the one that brought in Martin Luther King Jr. His house had 16 sticks of dynamite put under it, and it exploded while he was in the home. He was beaten when he tried to enroll his daughters in an all-white school in the 1960s. Reverend Shuttlesworth, certainly one of the unsung and sung heroes of the civil rights movement here in Birmingham, was here on hand to watch President Obama be inaugurated.
I would imagine that if there were to be a place where there would be tears flowing today, that Birmingham, Alabama would be that place.
You know, we saw a little bit of tears, but we saw a whole lot of dancing and flag waving and chanting. It really was just an entire crowd, thousands of people, very, very invigorated and engaged in the process. And talking about, you know, how it took this long to get to this place, I talked to a woman named Connie Hunt, who grew up in South Alabama. She was born in the 1950s, and she talked about having to walk into the backs of restaurants, not being able to enter through the front door, and about how schools were segregated. And she talked about how important it was to her now that things have changed so much, that this was a symbol of the change that this state and this country have gone through.
Tanya, thank you so much.
Thank you.
That was Tanya Ott, news director for WGHM in Birmingham, Alabama. She joined us from the studios there. Now we're going to go back to D.C. where NPR reporter Allison Keyes joins us. Hey, Allison.
Hey, Tony.
You know, we have seen the crowds. We've heard the speeches. What did the people do right after the speeches were over and after Obama left the Capitol steps?
Actually, I am not on the mall. I'm on U Street, which is a historic district. U Street was basically the hot seat of black culture and commerce. It was Harlem before Harlem. Pearl Bailey called it Black Broadway. And this neighborhood was decimated by the riots in 1968. Affluent blacks fled. Then it became a drug haven. Now it's been revitalized and gentrified. And people here were absolutely jubilant. I heard you talking to Ron about how people react, or how President Bush was reacting today, and people here who watched the speech on a jumbotron at the restaurant where I am actually laughed at Bush's reaction shots during President Obama's speech, particularly when President Obama said, America is a friend of each nation and we are ready to lead. But other than that, people here were rapt. They sat with tears in their eyes. Couples held on to each other. They cheered through the speeches. They cheered when the Carters and Clintons came out. They even cheered when Obama's daughters were taking pictures with the camera. People here were really excited.
Would you say that there was a generational difference noticeable at all between the people who were there who responded to what they saw on the Jumbotron?
Actually, no. Where I am, people brought their children. People brought their grandparents. It was a very racially mixed crowd. And I actually spoke to one woman. She's 64. Her name's Pene Durant. She was here in 1968 during the riots. She said she was so glad to be alive to see this. Her 96-year-old father, who was in an assisted living facility in Virginia, was watching it as well. And they were so glad to be here. Across the table from her was a white couple, who brought their toddler, who was wearing an Obama T-shirt. They were equally glad to be here. It was really quite something to watch. Very emotional.
So from their standpoint, it clearly is, truly is a new day and a new way of looking at things, correct?
One woman I spoke to, Melanie Garrett, called this a great getting up morning.
Thank you very much, Allison.
You're welcome, Tony.
That was NPR reporter Allison Keyes joining us from the nation's capital. This is News in Notes. I'm Tony Cox. It's estimated that between 1 to 2 million people crammed onto the National Mall and along the parade route to catch a glimpse of President Obama's inauguration today. One of those people was author and multimedia journalist Farai Chadeya, joining us now by phone from the nation's capital. Hey, Farai.
Hey, Tony.
How you doing? Listen, describe for us the mood in the crowd during the ceremony. We're getting all these very interesting stories.
It was incredibly beautiful. I went with my mother, and I was lucky enough to be able to get a seat, which really, you know, I think it was great to have a seat, but it wasn't as big a deal as some people felt. Everybody had a good seat. There was, because you were there for the people and with the people. And, you know, there was a couple next to us, you know, with young kids speaking French to them, and there were people, this couple, really cute, kissing, you know, when Obama was inaugurated behind us, and, you know, just old friends of mine. I mean, it was just incredible.
We know.
And yet, we saw someone, you know, of course, we're hearing the news that a couple of the senators, Kennedy and Byrd, became ill after the ceremony, and we did see one woman, an older woman, having to be helped by the medics. I think that, you know, the temperatures did take a toll on some people.
That was going to be my question. You couldn't tell from watching on television how cold it was because it was beautiful and sunny. The weather was an issue for some folks, obviously.
Yeah, it was. And you know, people did everything from bringing full-on sleeping bags to wearing what looked like, you know, fall clothes for a stroll in the park. People had very different strategies about what they were going to bring. They had very different understandings of what the security lines would let them bring in. There were huge piles of debris afterwards from things people couldn't bring onto the mall. You know, it was organized chaos. I mean, it went off really smoothly considering, but there were certainly moments where people didn't completely know what to do. But there was no one who I've heard of who had a bad time. The only time that things are bad here are when you're trying to catch a taxi because there aren't any.
Well, you know, Metro Police said there were no arrests, at least initially, as a result of all those people being there, which is remarkable in and of itself. You could have that large a crowd and everyone be that well behaved.
People were amazing. I saw these young brothers last night, and they were like, "Where's the mall?" And this is 1 o'clock in the morning, and I'm like, "Oh, there's not going to be any parking over there." They're like, "We just drove from Chicago. Where's the mall?" I was like, "That way." So people just brought their A game.
All right, Farai, thank you very much.
Thank you, Tony.
That was author and multimedia journalist Farai Chadeya speaking to us from Washington, D.C. President Barack Obama called on Americans today to join him in facing the nation's challenges. The 44th president promised bold and swift action to revive the struggling economy, and he pledged to restore America's standing in the world. Joining me now is Karen Grigsby Bates, correspondent for NPR's National Desk. Karen and I watched the speech together. Hey, Karen.
Hi, Tony.
You know, okay, it's been a, hour or more since we finished watching it. What sticks with you?
A couple of things. One thing was that this was a speech that, you know, in past inaugural speeches, every couple of seconds you get a lot of clapping that interrupt the speech. People really listened to this speech. When you look at the camera shots that were panning the mall, and people everywhere seemed to be paying particular attention to now President Obama's words, and they were taking it very seriously. And it wasn't a feel-good speech. He gave this whole catalog of challenges that the nation was going to have to face, from economic to foreign relations to health care to education. He just sort of threw it all out there.
As a matter of fact, we're going to play a clip that makes the point that you are just making. This is an excerpt from President Obama's speech earlier today, acknowledging that the country faces many challenges.
What the cynics fail to understand is that the ground has shifted beneath them, that the stale political arguments that have consumed us for so long no longer apply. The question we ask today is not whether our government is too big or too small, but whether it works.
I know, Karen, that you thought, for example, that this was a great speech. You said so.
I did. I thought it ranked right up there. There were snatches of lots of previous great inaugural speeches. There were definitely echoes of John Fitzgerald Kennedy's 1961 inaugural speech.
Absolutely.
And of Martin Luther King's March on Washington address. And there were, and I think this was intentional, a lot of Lincoln-esque touches to this. And I think the way people listened to it was almost Lincoln-esque. You know, when Lincoln did the Gettysburg Address, nobody clapped afterwards and he thought it was a failure. And one of his aides explained to him, "Mr. President, it was like a prayer. You don't clap after a prayer."
Very interesting. And, you know, we got advanced copies of the speech. And as I went through it, marking it up, you're absolutely right. There are several places where you can see references that remind you of MLK or of Kennedy and other past presidents, Lincoln, even Roosevelt. I want to ask you about one of the expected controversies, which may or may not have turned out to be that, and that is the appearance of Reverend Rick Warren to give the invocation. Anything surprise you about Rick Warren's message?
It was more temperate than I thought it was maybe going to be. You know, there was a lot of speculation ahead of time because he feels very strongly about things like single-sex same-sex marriage. He thinks that that's the wrong thing. He thinks he's a warrior against abortion. And he's been very upfront about staking that claim, which has worked very well for his evangelical base, but it's also been very divisive when it's tried to go beyond that base. So some of the speculation was he was going to bring those things into the speech. I didn't hear them, although I missed the first minute of his speech. So if he did it very quickly, then he did it before I noticed. The other thing that happened was there was some speculation about how he was going to close his address. The thought was, if you mention God, if you mention a higher authority, many people around the world have their version of God that they worship. They're fine with that. Mention Jesus, and you exclude huge numbers of the listeners who were hearing that. And he did indeed stay true to his evangelical roots and mention Jesus as his God and Savior. So some people did find that off-putting.
Let me ask you to stick around because we're going to bring in a couple of other voices to our conversation and continue it. Joining us now is Mary Frances Berry, professor of history at the University of Pennsylvania and the former chair of the U.S. Civil Rights Commission, and Robert Trainum, the D.C. bureau chief for the Comcast network CNN. Robert and Mary, nice to have you back.
Hey, Tony.
Tony,
happy inauguration.
Same to you. Mary, let me begin with you because you must be tired. When we talked to you yesterday, you were in Ohio heading back to D.C. Did you get back in time to see it, and what was your reaction to being there?
I got back in time to not only do some media last night, but to observe the whole thing and to be out with the people and seeing what was going on and how they were feeling. Yes, indeed. And so it's a very high-spirited day, a little bit dim by the illness of Senator Kennedy with the seizure that he had during the inauguration proceedings, but a great day.
Robert, was there something that stood out for you positively or otherwise about, A, the ceremony, and, B, about the President Obama's speech?
I would say overall, Tony, you know, we stood on the footsteps of democracy's front porch, which is obviously the U.S. Capitol, and hundreds of thousands, maybe even millions, well, time will only tell, we'll see exactly how many people were there, stood there in silence, and they listened to their new president unify the country. And, you know, regardless of whether you're Republican or Democrat, liberal versus conservative, it was very moving to me to look around and see so many people listening attentively to the new president and saying, you know what, I wish him well. You know, this is the beauty of our country, is that, you know, for 2 years we fought and we scraped and we talked about being red versus blue and Republican versus Democrat, but today we're all Americans, and that was very special.
Well, you know, in the past, President Obama has been reluctant to directly address his place as the first African-American president, but today, well, here's what he said in his speech.
This is the meaning of our liberty and our creed, why men and women and children of every race and every faith can join in celebration across this magnificent mall. And why a man whose father less than 60 years ago might not have been served at a local restaurant can now stand before you to take a most sacred oath.
That was a telling passage, wasn't it, Mary?
Well, I think so. I think it was an oblique reference to his racial origins, but one doesn't expect more than that. His whole campaign has been about downplaying the race question, and nobody should have expected him to play it up today. But that was a reference to his racial origins, and he got it in. As a matter of fact, the only thing that I saw that he did not include, he even talked in one phrase about not only people of different religions, but people who are not religious. I thought in light of the Rick Warren controversy, he might at least at some point mention the word gay, you know, in the litany of people who live in America, in order to say that. But I didn't see that in
there. I noticed that as well. Karen, Obama directly addressed some of the nation's problems, the struggling economy, wars in Afghanistan and Iraq. Do you think that he gave the people who did not vote for him the confidence that he can tackle these problems?
I think he sounded really definite, really purposeful, and in it for the long haul. You know, as Jesse Jackson used to like to say on the campaign trail, this ain't a sprint, this is a marathon. And he's basically saying, this is not going to be all good times, folks. You know, we're really going to have to roll up our sleeves and work. But we could do it during the Depression. We did it during other stressful times in the nation's history, and we can do it now. We have to stop babying ourselves, and we have to roll up our sleeves and get to work.
There's no way to know so soon, Robert, what the country's reaction to him is going to be based on just a few hours of being in office. But given what you have seen and heard just so far, do you have a sense of how well he will be accepted by the rest of the nation, given what he said and did so far today?
You're right, Tony. Only time will tell. Look, President Obama has already demonstrated himself to be a moderate. He is a centrist. He has already alienated the liberal left wing of his party by having Rick Warren give the invocation, by talking about the need to continue in Afghanistan, by talking about the need to perhaps keep the Bush tax cuts in place. So he's already governing from the center, and there's a lot of people out there that's going to be very upset with him. And the reason why is because he's a very gifted politician who has spoke very lofty words during the campaign, and he said A, but now he's willing to do B. And so what you saw, at least what I saw during the inauguration, is him lowering expectations. The question becomes, Tony, is whether or not his millions of supporters out there will be able to have the patience to be able to say, you know what, I understand that he has to govern now, I understand he has to govern from the center, but most importantly, just as importantly, is the 2012 elections are right around the corner, and of course, the president and his team are already looking at the elections and saying, you know what, in order for us to do any monumental change, we're going to have to wait until 2012 for us to get elected first, and the only way we can do that is to govern from the center.
Well, I thought it was more of the same in terms of the tone and tenor of his speech. I thought it was also very effective to put the burden of change not just on himself and the government, but on the people out there, so that if things do not change fast enough, part of it is the responsibility of the people. He put that out there, and I also thought it was interesting in the litany of values that he's now trying to renew. He talked about hard work and patriotism and all the values. It sort of reminded me of when Bill Clinton used to talk about the people who work hard and play by the rules, the same kind of theme. And the responsibility reminded me of George Bush and all of his talk about responsibility. And in fact, Bush won. Several presidents have reprised that theme. It was very, very effective. but more of the same and vintage Obama.
Well, to talk about responsibility, let's close the conversation with this thought, because Obama chose Reverend Joseph Lowery to give the closing prayer at today's inaugural ceremony. Now, Lowery co-founded the Southern Christian Leadership Conference in 1957 with Martin Luther King. Here is part of how he ended his benediction.
Lord, in the memory of all the saints who from their labors rest, and in the joy of a new beginning, we ask you to help us work for that day when black will not be asked to get back, when brown can stick around, when yellow will be mellow, when the red man can get ahead, man, and when white will embrace what is right. Let all those who do justice and love mercy say amen.
Now, Karen, you and I, we smiled when he said that as we were watching him.
We did, but we have been churched in the black church, and we knew where that was going, you know. And it was a really interesting bookend. You know, you have Rick Warren at the very beginning opening this ceremony, and then this battle-scarred veteran of the civil rights movement closing it, beginning with this hymn-like stanza, the third stanza of the Negro National Anthem, which was written in 1899.
That's right.
And closing with basically stuff you might jump rope to when you were 10 years old, you know, but he got everything in.
Well, let Mary and Robert get in here in the last couple of minutes that we have. Mary, were you surprised to hear him say those things?
Well, I was surprised, but of course it's very familiar. But some other people who were listening who don't know that history and tradition said, you know, is that politically correct to keep talking about the yellow man and the red man and all the rest? And I had to explain to them that that's part of the tradition.
Robert, yeah, what did you think when you heard that?
Organized shock. And the reason why I say that is because as a black man, and obviously seeing a black man being inaugurated and seeing a sea of black faces, I was very at home by hearing those words as someone had mentioned a few moments ago about just being schooled in the black church. A little shocked, a little taken aback that was said at an inauguration. But having said that, you know, this is a moment that, frankly speaking, that every single day that Barack Obama is president, whether it be to 2012 or to 2016, he will be rewriting history. And I think he will be schooling all of us and reminding all of us about what it means to be a black person in America.
I want to thank all of you for participating, your comments and insight. And I want to just end by telling you something that I read in the Washington Post today in a column of Eugene Robinson, which I thought was very apropos of our description of America with a new black president. Quote, "Our mental furniture is being rearranged," end quote. Mary Frances Berry, professor of history at the University of Pennsylvania and the former chair of the U.S. Civil Rights Commission, Robert Trainum, the D.C. bureau chief of the Comcast network CNN, and Karen Grigsby Bates, an NPR correspondent for the National Desk. One and all, thank you very much.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Bye-bye.
I'm Tony Cox, and this is News and Notes. Some moments in history are best remembered in photos. And as President Barack Obama was sworn in today, Gil Garcetti had his camera lens trained on that history-making event. The former Los Angeles district attorney turned world-class photographer joins us now. Gil, nice to have you.
Tony, been a long time.
It has been a long time. Listen, Gil, you are one of the official inauguration photographers traveling with the Biden motorcade yesterday in front of the Capitol right today. I guess I should ask you this. Did you get the money shot you were looking for?
Well, I'm working with a great team of photographers, too. We're with the ObamaPhotoBook.com group. We're the official inaugural book photographers. And certainly, I encourage any of your listeners, if they took any photographs here in Washington, D.C., or even at home, send them in. We may include those photographs in the book. It's ObamaPhotoBook.com. And, you know, yeah, I got some, I think, some decent photographs. But yesterday was a particularly wonderful day because it was only one photographer plus myself with the vice president. And then, to everyone's surprise, The then president-elect Obama showed up at the Biden event, and so we got some, I think, some pretty good stuff.
Well, here's my question for you as a photographer. When you have a person who is as photographed as Barack Obama has been, and if, for God's sake, is going to be for the next 4 years, how do you find a shot that separates you from the rest of the crowd of photographers when he is your subject and target?
Well, certainly that is an exceedingly difficult thing to do. But you try and capture, you know, the moment, because he is a man that connects with the crowd and with the message that he has. So you're looking for that little twinkle in his eye or that little different look that he may have. But frankly, Tony, a lot of my work was gauging the crowd as they were entranced with the day. And it was such a wonderful group, such a wonderful experience for us all to be there. And I tried to capture some of this on film, because there were black people, there were white people, there were Asian people, there were brown people there. And I have never been in a mob like today, just in terms of the density of the crowd. But everyone was so cool. And when they announced, when they introduced the then president-elect, and when he came, I mean, it was a roar, and you try and capture some of that on film.
Now, I have about 20 seconds for you to answer this. When he actually put his hand on the Bible and said and accepted the oath, were your cameras trained on the crowd at that moment, and did you get a shot?
I did. That's where it was, because I wasn't up close to him. My interest was really in the crowd. And that's what I was trying to focus on.
Well, and that's why they selected you, Gil Garcetti, because you know what to do with the camera. It's a pleasure to have you on. And
Tony, thank you so much.
We want to have you back, all right?
Good deal.
All right.
Thanks.
Thank you very much. That was photographer Gil Garcetti. You can see Gil's inaugural photos at our website, nprnewsandnotes.org.
God of our weary years, God of our silent tears, thou who hast brought us thus far on our way.
There is a sense of national pride among African Americans like never before with today's inauguration. A song written in 1899 that celebrates that pride is Lift Every Voice and Sing, known originally as the Negro National Anthem. You're hearing Kim Weston singing it in the background. She sang it for the inauguration of the outgoing president, George W. Bush, in 2001, and she was the first major pop star to ever record the song. It wasn't sung today, but is often heard at major black cultural events.
When we say no more yes about what time is it?
That's Jesse Jackson at the 1972 Black Cultural Megafest known as What's That?
Mr. Kim Weston, the Black National Anthem.
Lift every voice and sing till earth and heaven ring, ring with a whole.
So, Kim, here you are, singing live at the L.A. Coliseum, 1972, stadium full of afros and fists in the air.
Oh, yes. I'm glad you mentioned that. Yes, yes. I was told that I was blackballed because when the record company saw those fists go up, they thought it was a militant thing, you know. But it was nation time, and that really was the first time that I'd seen anything like that. And it just overwhelmed me. It really did. It was a wonderful occasion at White Stacks.
Had you ever sung that song before, that kind, that size of an audience?
Oh, no. There were over 100,000 people there at that particular day.
That song, of course, was written in 1900 by James Weldon Johnson in honor of Abraham Lincoln. How did it happen that you came to record that song in 1968?
Listen, I learned Lift Every Voice and Sing here in Detroit at Brownson Elementary School in kindergarten, and I'm 102 now. You know,
Come on. Well, you know what? Let's talk about Motown a little bit, because you mentioned Detroit, and your career obviously got a big boost during the time that you were at Motown. But at the time that you were about to leave Motown, you left there on, well, I don't know if you call it a high note or not, but you had a pretty big hit, you and Marvin Gaye together.
Well, you know what? Actually, Marvin and I had recorded that song 2 years. We recorded an upper two albums over 2 years prior to that. And that was one of the reasons that I left, because I didn't feel that I was being treated fairly. You know, of course, Motown played, they made me national or international. I learned an awful lot while at Motown, and they played a very important part in my career.
Do you feel like you made the wrong decision by leaving?
I do not regret leaving, because if you remember in the 60s, the life of a record was about 3 months. And if you had a hit, usually they would release your next single before that one died down. So as soon as they stopped playing the hit, they had the new record. Well, I never got a release. I got a release every 6 to 9 months, whether I had a hit record or not. And I didn't think that was fair.
It takes two, baby. It takes two, baby. Me and you. Just take two.
It Takes Two. Was that your biggest hit?
That was my biggest hit with Marvin. My biggest single by myself was Take Me in Your Arms. And I never had an album while I was at Motown. It created a big void for me.
You went to England and became, or you became a star in England, I should say. And I know that you signed with MGM Records. You've been quoted as saying that you finally felt free to sing the songs that you wanted to sing after you left Motown. Was Lift Every Voice one of those songs?
Lift Every Voice was one of the songs, and going back to your original question, how did I come about singing that? I sung at a Lakers Knickerbocker championship game. I did the Star Spangled Banner, and the switchboard lit up, I guess, like it did when Marvin did it. And so when they asked me about recording the Star Spangled Banner, I said the only anthem I was interested in recording was Lift Every Voice. So that's how that came about.
So you are political.
You think so?
Sounds like it. Just a little.
Well, you know, I've done a lot of things. I worked close with Reverend Jackson for a good while. And the church that I was raised in, you know, there's politics in everything, Tony. You know,
mm-hmm.
Life. If you got rules and regulations, there's politics.
You're right.
You know what I'm saying? I don't care where it is. So my thing was that I felt that I needed to do what I could to help my people, not saying that I wouldn't help anybody and everybody. But I was asked once by Miriam Makeba, which of course was an honor, to come to Africa and help. And she was saying that because of Lift Every Voice. And I said, but Miriam, and I said, my people here in America, and this was before the Voting Rights Act was passed. I said, my people here are suffering, maybe not like your people, but considering where I came from, I feel that we were going through some similar struggles, you know?
Now, let me ask you this, because you've already talked, and it's really interesting and fascinating to hear about singing at the Laker game. I think I saw that, by the way.
Oh, yeah?
I think I did. And we know that you did it at Watt Stacks, but you sang Lift Every Voice on an occasion that when I heard about it, it struck
Your
me
mouth
as,
blew up.
Yeah, you know it did. The inauguration of President Bush in 2001. That seems like an odd pairing, was it?
When the invitation came, I thought somebody was playing with me, but my friend that called me to tell me that I had an invitation to sing for President Bush told me that the Bush campaign was trying to find a way to bridge that void between the black community and the Republican Party, and they asked, would I sing Lift Every Voice at the inauguration? Well, I'd never been invited to sing for a president before, so I didn't care what party he was with. I said yes.
Okay. So it wasn't an issue whether you were a supporter or not a supporter of George Bush.
Absolutely not. And anybody that asked me, I told them, I said, well, listen, he's still my president. I don't care if he is a Republican.
Yes.
So, and the fact that he requested me to sing that, I considered that an honor, you know. And I haven't said this on an interview anywhere, but I'm doing my autobiography. I do have that in there. In his finale line, I'm the only person that he kissed. So I was kind of impressed with him in the very beginning. I got a little upset with him a little afterwards, you know.
Did you take a picture with him?
Yes, I took a picture with him.
Yeah, is there a story about that picture?
Well, there is one, but I'm saving it for my book, Tony.
Kim Weston, let me ask you this. As a song, how would you characterize Lift Every Voice and Sing?
As a song, Lift Every Voice and Sing is one of the hardest songs there is to sing. It's equipped. Well, you know what? Actually, I heard that it was submitted to be the national anthem for the country. But the Star Spangled Banner won, you know. But it's not blues, it's not gospel, but it's almost classical. I've always loved the song because it has a special meaning for me because when I started out, I said I was raised in a section of Detroit called Black Bottom. But in Black Bottom, though, we used it as a community, and we had a lot of pride. And the fact that I learned this song in kindergarten, I think, shows that.
Won't you sing it with me, everybody? Sing a song.
That was singer Kim Weston. She's the first major pop star to record Lift Every Voice and Sing, a song known today as the Black National Anthem. Weston was not asked to sing the song at today's inauguration, but she wants President Obama to know, for the future, he only needs to say the word, and she'll be there, tuned up and ready to go.
I, Barack Hussein Obama,
I, Barack Hussein Obama, do solemnly swear
that I will execute the office of President to the United States faithfully.
That I will execute
the office of President of the United States.
The office of President of the United States faithfully.
And will, to the best of my ability.
And will, to the best of my ability.
Preserve, protect, and defend the Constitution of the United States.
Preserve, protect, and defend the Constitution of the United States.
So help you God.
So help me God.
Congratulations, Mr. President.
Say it plain. That many have died for this day. Sing the names of the dead who brought us here, who laid the train tracks, raised the bridges, picked the cotton and the lettuce, built brick by brick the glittering edifices they would then keep clean and work inside of.
We ask you to help us work for that day. When black will not be asked to get back, when brown can stick around, when yellow will be mellow, when the red man can get ahead, man, and when white will embrace what is right.
Praise song for struggle. Praise song for the day.
Let all those who do justice and love mercy say amen. Say amen.
On this day, we gather because we have chosen hope over fear, unity of purpose over conflict and discord.
Let free, freedom, freedom ring.
The time has come to reaffirm our enduring spirit, to choose our better history, to carry forward that precious gift, that noble idea passed on from generation to generation. The God-given promise that all are equal, all are free, and all deserve a chance to pursue their full measure of happiness. To all the other peoples and governments who are watching today, from the grandest capitals to the small village where my father was born, know that America is a friend of each nation and every man, woman, and child who seeks a future of peace and dignity, and we are ready to lead once more.
Oh,
Starting today, we must pick ourselves up, dust ourselves off, and begin again the work of remaking America. Let it be said by our children's children that when we were tested, we refused to let this journey end, that we did not turn back, nor did we falter. And with eyes fixed on the horizon and God's grace upon us, we carried forth that great gift of freedom and delivered it safely to future generations. Thank you. God bless you. And God bless the United States of America.
That was Chief Justice John Roberts, President Barack Obama, poet Elizabeth Alexander, and civil rights veteran Reverend Joseph Lowry.